स्वामी नामिने नमस्ते सरस्वती देवे गौरवाणी प्रचारिणे निर्विशेष शून्यवादी पाश्चात्य देश तारिणे जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिवासादि गौर भक्तवृंद हरे कृष्णा 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Today we are reading from Canto 10, Chapter 56, Verses 38 to 45. So what we'll do is, thank you very much for a great performance today. Very inspiring. So I've decided to go on big distribution tomorrow with Kalia Panipuru. Text 38, let's chant all of the verses together. So we'll start, text 38. Satrajitam samahuya sabhayam rajasannidhav praktim chakhyaya bhagavan manim tasmai nyavedayat. Translation. Lord Krishna summoned Satrajit to the royal assembly. There in the presence of King Ugrasen, Krishna announced the recovery of the jewel and then formally presented it to Satrajit. Text 39. Sachati vridito ratnam gruhitva vang mukhastatah anutapya mano bhavanam agamat svena papmanam. Hanging his head in great shame, Satrajit took the gem and returned home, all the while feeling remorse for his sinful behavior. Text 42. Sonudhyayam stadevagham balabhat vigrahakulah katham rajami atmarajah prasidet vachutah katham kim krutva sadunayam sya na shapet vajano yatha adhirga darshanam kshudram Moodham Dravina Lolupam Dase Duhitaram Tasmai Stri Ratnam Ratnamevacha Upayoyam Sami Chinas Tasya Shanti Nachanyatha. Translation. Pondering over his grievous offense and worried about the possibility of conflict with the Lord's mighty devotees, King Satrajit thought, how can I cleanse myself of my contamination and how may Lord Achyuta become satisfied with me? What can I do to regain my good fortune and avoid being cursed by the populace for being so short-sighted, miserly, foolish and avaricious? I shall give my daughter the jewel of all women to the Lord together with the Samantak jewel. That indeed is the only proper way to pacify him. Text 43. Evam nevasito buddhya satrajit svasutam shubham manincha swayamudyamya krishnaya upajaharaha. Having thus intelligently made up his mind, King Satrajit personally arranged to present Lord Krishna with his fair daughter in his Samantak jewel. Text 44. Tam satyabhamam bhagavan upayene yathabhidhi bahubhiryachitam shila rupaudarya munanvitam. The Lord married Satyabhama in proper religious fashion, possessed of excellent behavior, along with beauty, broad-mindedness, and all other good qualities. She had been sought by many men. Purport. Srila Sridhar Swami explains that men such as Kritavarma had sought the hand of Satyabhama. Text 45. Bhagavanahana manim pratichamo vayam rupa Tavastam deva bhaktasya vayam cha parabhagina. The Supreme Personality of Godhead told Saprajit, we do not care to take this jewel back, O king. You are the sun god's devotee, so let it stay in your possession. Thus, we will also enjoy its benefits. Saprajit should have worshipped Lord Krishna, the Supreme God. Thus, there is certainly a touch of irony in Lord Krishna's saying, after all, you are a devotee of the sun god. Furthermore, Krishna had already acquired Satrajit's greatest treasure, the pure and beautiful Satyabhama. Thus, and the purports, the humble servants of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, to the 10th canto, 56th chapter of Srimad Bhagavatam entitled The Samantic Jewel. Om Ajnana Timurandasya, Jnanan Yunushalakaya, Chakshuran Militam Yena, Trismai Shri Guru Venamaha. So for those who came in late, that means those who did not get a chance to hear what has gone on so far, I'm going to summarize. This is the end of the chapter. I'll summarize what's going on. Then I want to explain a principle to the students of the Bhaktivedanta Academy and see how the description here flows with that explanation, how it meshes with that explanation, or with that principle, rather. So in this chapter, we see a king, a greedy king. His name is Saprajit. And this king is a worshipper of the sun god, who is a demigod. And he has a jewel, which is, his name is Yamantaka. This jewel is extremely brilliant. It has the radiance of the sun. And it produces 170 pounds of gold every day. So Satrajit is so obsessed with this jewel that he puts it in a temple in Dwaraka and hires brahmanas to worship the jewel. And then what happens is that at some point Krishna actually requests him for the jewel, so that for King Ugrasen, the ruling king at the time, so that the king can do good for the society as a whole. We have wealth, and that's the logic. So Krishna asks for the jewel, and he says no. And then, by a series of unfortunate circumstances, his brother is killed for the jewel. The jewel ends up with Jambavan. He's a devotee of Krishna. And then the jewel is recovered by Krishna and brought back to Dwaraka along with a new wife, Jambavati, for Krishna. And that's where we are now, text of view. So we look at the PowerPoint that I have. Just a quick review of the principle I was talking about, and then we'll see how that works in this chapter and also what we discussed today. I don't know if you can read. Can you read at the back? It's too small. So this is the principle I want to discuss today. This is Uttam Bhakti, pure devotional service. So who knows who's a pure devotee here? Anybody heard of a pure devotee here? Loudly, Srila. Srila Prabhupada. So, yes, Srila Prabhupada is a pure devotee, and the symptoms of Srila Prabhupada are captured in this verse. Pure devotional service. So this verse is Anya Vilashita Shunyam Jnana Karmadi Anavritam Anukulena Krishna Anushilanam Bhakti Uttama. I put the meanings of the words on there because they're not so easily available. And then I'll show you the translation that Prabhupada gives of this verse. So Anya means any other. Abhilashita, desires. Jnana, mental speculation, philosophical speculation. Karma, I just rendered it as karma because karma has many meanings. And they're all included in this definition of karma. Anavritam is not covered. Avritam means covered. Anavritam is not covered. Not covered by jnana and karma. Anukulena, which is favorably. Anushilanam. Shilanam means service. The word shila in Sanskrit, the root, that means service. So shilanam is service. Anu means continuous. So continuous service. Anushilanam. Bhaktir uttama. That's uttam bhakti. That's the definition. This is a question of definition. What is bhakti? If somebody asks you, what is devotion? What is bhakti? Then this is the definition. This is the answer. Bhakti we start with Uttama Bhakti, and that is this definition. So the translation is, Prabhupada gives, this is Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Nectar of Devotion 1.1.11. One should render transcendental loving service to the Supreme Lord Krishna favorably and without desire for material profit or gain through fruitive activities or philosophical speculation. This is called pure devotional service. So, the main points here, no other desires but to serve Krishna favorably and without material profit or gain. You know, we don't want anything for ourselves. And without any speculation, any philosophical or mental speculation. So I'll touch upon each of these points in today's class. Yes, thank you. So, let's see what Satrajit's situation is. Is Satrajit the pure devotee by the definition we have up there? Why not? Can we apply this verse to diagnose Satrajit's level of devotion? So, you know, he's, first of all, not favorable to Krishna. Because Krishna asks for something and he says, no, I'm not giving it to you. Krishna asks for the jewel and Satrajit says, no, that's not favorable, right? The second point is that, I forgot to mention, Satrajit actually spreads rumors about Krishna, nasty rumors. So he says that, oh, this jewel, his brother was killed when he went to the forest with the jewel, and he says, my brother was killed by Krishna. Must have been. And he must have stolen the jewel because I said no. So he, slanders Krishna. So not only is not favorable, but he is pratikul. He's not anukul, but he's pratikul. He is unfavorably disposed to Krishna. So, other than that, he has abhilasha, not anya abhilashita shunyam, but anya abhilashita, how should I say, lakshyam, millions of desires. He has plenty of desires, as evident from the fact that he is worshipping a jewel in the city of Dwaraka. So he wants gold and wealth and whatever it is. But what that does is it perverts the mind to forget who Krishna is, what his position is. This jewel is brilliant. Krishna explains in the 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Yad Aditya Gadam Tejo Jagat Bhasayati Akhilam Yad Chandramasi Yad Chagno Tat Tejo Vidhimamakam. The light of the sun, moon, fire, Jagat Bhasayati Akhilam, that warms the entire world, universe. Tat Tejo Vidhimamakam, that is my energy, my light, my radiance. So the Samantaka jewel is Krishna's, because the radiance of everything or anything is Krishna's. So he's simply asking for what belongs to him back. There's nothing wrong with giving it back to him. When Krishna approaches us for something, or by extension if the Guru approaches us with a request, we shouldn't have the unfortunate intelligence to say no. And that intelligence typically is born out of obsession for material things. Over-obsession, losing our balance, not understanding the real nature, the reality of things. So it's quite interesting. This chapter is a study in, actually also a study in pure devotion. So another aspect of this chapter is is seen in the behavior of Jambavan, the king of the bears, who wrestles with Krishna, and the residents of Dwaraka, Devaki, Vasudev, Rukmini Devi. So Krishna fights with this bear in the cave to get the jewel back. Not really to get the jewel back, but that's how it unfolds. And when the fight's going on, Jambavan suddenly realizes that he is fighting with Krishna. So this is explained in the Nectar of Devotion by Srila Prabhupada, towards related chapters, where a pure devotee has different relationships and emotions. Jambavan is in the mode of Dasya. He is a servant of Lord Ram. That's his relationship with Krishna. And when he is fighting with Krishna, he doesn't recognize Krishna. Just like Satrajit doesn't understand who Krishna is. But as he's fighting, he comes to the realization, and then he's filled with dread. That's the emotion that is an ecstasy. It's an emotion of ecstasy. That's how Prabhupada writes. The emotion of dread and ghastliness, that's the chapter. And he quotes, he mentions Jambavan there, Rukshuraj. So Jambavan is in fear. Why is he in fear? Because he's just realized that he has offended the Supreme Lord. So he has committed the offense, just like Satrajit committed the offense, but he's not blind. He immediately recognizes what has happened. And then he's filled with fear. What have I done? Fear of Krishna. What have I done? And then Prabhupada writes beautifully that Krishna pacifies him. Don't worry. You know, I enjoyed fighting with you. You know, because Jambavan starts to tremble and his face goes dry. And then Krishna assures him, don't worry about this. You know, if you would like to fight some more, I would love to fight with you. So Krishna is actually sporting with him, enjoying with him. But Jambavan is filled with dread. And then he sings these beautiful prayers that were described in this chapter. Again, glorifying Krishna's position. You are the super soul. You are the life breath. You are everything. So, and then Vasudev and Devaki and Rukmini, their behavior is also instructive. So what do they do? When they hear that Krishna is probably killed in the cave with fighting with Jambavan, they pray to Durga, the demigod. It's just like Satrajit is praying to the sun god, who is a demigod. The residents of Dwaraka, they pray to Durga Devi. But what are they asking for? They want Krishna's safe return. And they're lamenting. That's also dread, actually. It's coincidence, maybe not coincidence. But this chapter has the bhava, the emotions of dread in it. Because Prabhupada explains there are two kinds of dread here. One is when we realize we have offended Krishna. That's one kind of fear. Another is when we come across a situation which Krishna is in danger. And that invokes dread inside the heart. We're extremely afraid. And so this is the emotion that Vasudev, Devaki and Rukmini are experiencing when Krishna is in the has not returned from the cave. And so they're praying to the demigoddess, but they're doing it for Krishna's return. So this is Annabhilashita Shunyam. Jnana Karmadi Anabhutam. Karma means fruitive activities, desire for material benefit, but it also means Karma Yoga, even Nishkam Karma Yoga comes under it. That's why I didn't translate karma as fruitive activities only. So this is the position of the pure devotees, which you can see. There is a contrast here. There's pure devotees and then there is Satrajit, who is clearly not a pure devotee by any definition. Because you can analyze it and you can see he is not clear about Krishna's position. He is unfavorable towards Krishna. He tries to slander him. But now what is happening today in these verses is that Krishna summons him to the royal assembly and gives him the jewel. So now Satrajit is ashamed. It's very instructive, and Sanatana Goswami Pada also comments on this. So Satrajit takes the gem and he's feeling remorse, he's feeling ashamed of his behavior. Papamana, for his sinful behavior. He's committed a sin by rejecting Krishna's request and by casting aspersions on his character. So in text 40 through 42, let's see what Satrajit is thinking, which is revealing. He says, how can I cleanse myself of my contamination? This is good for all of us to understand, to reflect like this. Because we are in a contaminated state ourselves. First of all, recognizing that we are in a contaminated state is a big step. And then once we recognize, now here Krishna's mercy has brought home the point to Satrajit. Krishna is giving him the jewel and explaining to him, I don't need the jewel. For us, it's the Guru who explains to us things as they are. So pondering of this grievous offense, it's an offense, how can I cleanse myself? And how may Lord Achyuta become satisfied with me again? What can I do to regain my good fortune? And avoid being cursed by the populace. Populace means devotees. If we have committed offenses towards devotees, we should think like this. How can I avoid being cursed by them? Because it's explained in the chapter, in some verses before, Shapitam, the residents of Dwaraka, Devaki, exalted pure devotees, Rukmini Devi, they are cursing Satrajit, not a good situation. So how can I avoid being cursed by the populace for being, and then there are four adjectives here, short-sighted, and we can reflect whether these apply to us, miserly, foolish, avaricious, at least changing our minds all the time. I shall give my daughter, the jewel of all. So he finds the solution. What's the solution? He offers his daughter, who is a jewel of all women, Stri Ratnam, that's the Sanskrit. Ratnam is jewel, Stri means of all the women. Ratnam, she is the jewel of all women, Satyabhama. And I will also give him the seventh jewel, and that way he'll be pacified. So he's trying to make amends. He's trying to make amends by giving Krishna these gifts. But surprisingly, we see that in text 45, Krishna rejects one of the gifts. He says, I don't want the jewel. I'll accept Satyabhama, but I will not accept the Siamantak jewel. So now the question is, why does he do that? And then Srila Prabhupada explains, it becomes clear in the next chapter, that actually Satrajit, after all this, has not come to his senses. That means he's not lost the attachment to the jewel yet. He doesn't really want to give the Siamantak jewel back. Rather, he wants to keep it, and he wants to give Satyabhama in marriage. That's the idea. So this is in contrast to Jambavan. As soon as he comes, he realizes who he's dealing with, immediately comes to his position as a devotee. But Satrajit, he doesn't really want to give the jewel back. And Krishna, being the super soul, Paramatma, in everybody's heart, Ishvara sarva bhutana amriddeshe arjuna tishtati, brahmayan sarva bhutana yantra arudhani mayaya. The Supreme Lord is situated in everyone's heart, and he directs the wanderings of the living entity as if seated on a machine. So he knows our desires. That's the point. Our inner desires. And he reciprocates. Krishna is not, is reciprocal. He's neither partial nor impartial. He's reciprocal. So he reciprocates with us depending on what we really have in our heart. So even if he offered the Siamantak jewel, he said, no, that's fine. Of course, he gives a very nice reason for it, because the relationship with Satrajit of Krishna now is father-in-law and son-in-law, Damad. So he's offering his respects. No, we thank you, please, you are the sun god's devotee, keep it in your possession, and we can enjoy its benefits because we are the citizens, and so we will enjoy the benefits of the gold and whatever material wealth. So Krishna is always perfect in every situation. You know, he says no, but such so politely that he gladdens the heart of Satrajit, who gladly keeps it, as you can see in the next chapter. And, you know, he's past satisfied with having the jewel. It's not like he's feeling crestfallen, oh no, Krishna rejected my gift. So you can see again, he doesn't have pure devotion, certainly. Now I want to come to the last point, and then we'll close. The last point has to do with Jnana, which I didn't touch on in this chapter. Jnana karmadi anavritam. So pure devotional service is not covered by mental speculation. And I think this has more to do with us. So when we read these pastimes, especially this chapter, it is very confusing. If you just look at it, you read it, you come in cold and you start reading it, it's very confusing. Because Krishna, who is supposed to be the Supreme Personality of Godhead, according to the devotees, what is he doing? He's worried about his reputation. Why does he care if somebody slanders him? He should be indifferent. I mean, that's just a foolish king who is greedy for wealth. So why is Krishna so? Also, Krishna asks for the jewel. He's the Supreme Lord. Why does he have to ask for the jewel? He can make a jewel and give it to Ugrasena. Or he fights with Jambavan, and he fights for 28 days. I mean, that's just a bear. The Supreme Lord who supports planets in the air, in space, and is the source of everything. Such a complex material world. How can he take 28 days to defeat a bear? You know, it doesn't compute. And what is this that I just described? This is all mental speculation. All our mind is, like Nagaraj Prabhu was saying yesterday, very active. It's always active, whether we know it or not. And we are constantly chewing on these things. And those create doubts in our heart. This is mental speculation. Uttam Bhakti is uncovered by mental speculation. And I am not an Uttama Bhakta, so by extension, it follows that I am mental speculator, some level or the other. The mental speculation may go on without us recognizing it or understanding it. Now that's different from having questions or honest doubts, not doubts, but something that you don't understand or comprehend. But really, whether it's mental speculation or not, becomes manifest based on what we do about the doubt. If we keep chewing on it and try to find solutions on our own, that's a problem. If we approach the acharyas and we ask, well, how do we understand this? But then, unfortunately, depending on our level of purity, we may approach the acharyas and the acharyas may give us an explanation, and then we might think, well, they're just jumping through hoops, they don't know what's going on. So complex, everything is so complicated. You know, Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur is explaining it this way and that way. Can't we just have this explanation, for example? Can't we just assume that it's Brahman and God is formless and that Krishna really does have a material body, and then this would all be fine? Easy to explain all of this. Now, why do you have to jump through these hoops and eat like this? And to explain the Leela, somebody said to me, everything for you is Leela. Whenever you don't have an explanation, you say it's Leela. So the finite cannot understand the infinite without the infinite's mercy. This is the difference between a devotee and a mental speculator. We have to understand our position. We can understand. We can't begin to understand. And even if we think we understand, we're still in illusion, because we can never really understand on our own strength anyway. But if we receive with a humble frame of mind, humble ourselves, recognize the infinite is infinite and we are finite, then we have some hope of someday getting rid of mental speculation. So Satrajit is also a mental speculator, because he's speculating, oh, maybe Krishna killed my brother. He must have. You know, when the mind goes that direction, becoming offensive to Krishna, it never stops. We were discussing positive feedback in science class that we went on to carry. It's a positive feedback. Once the mind goes off on the wrong track, it's a vicious cycle. It feeds itself. And that frenzy ultimately takes us away from Krishna. So it's very important to stay grounded in the reality that we are fallible, finite, living entities, with no real hope for understanding Krishna unless we receive mercy. So I'll end there. And if there are any comments or questions.
Hi, Father Prabhu, thank you. You mentioned that Krishna is neither favorable or unfavorable, but reciprocal. Can you explain?
I meant partial, not impartial, but reciprocal. So, there is this verse in the 9th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says, Samoham Sarva Bhuteshu. I am equal to everybody. Name Dveshu Asti Na Priyaha. There's nobody I dislike, and nobody who is priya, dear. But then the next line says, Ye bhajanti tu mam bhaktya, but those who worship me with devotion, maite teshu chapyam, they are in me and I am in them. It's kind of contradiction. Not a contradiction, but it seems like it's really confusing. So I am equal to everybody. God is equal to all living entities, whether the soul in the worm or the soul in the pure Brahmin. And even we are supposed to develop that vision as in the 5th chapter, Panditaha Samadarshana. So it's not like he hates Satrajit, or there's anything fundamentally wrong with Satrajit's soul. But he's reciprocal in the sense that those who want a relationship with him, he makes himself available for that relationship. And in fact, he becomes subordinate to his devotee. That is a verse in the Bhagavatam.
Sadhu bhir grastu hridayo bhaktair bhakta janatriya aham bhakta paradhino.
I am subordinate to my devotee. So the devotee can purchase Krishna. Krishna becomes like he's a menial servant for Arjuna.
charioteer is a menial servant in servitorship for a king like Krishna. And he's a menial servant for Arjuna. So that's God serving his devotee. But then somebody might claim, well, why is not God serving me? You know, why is God indifferent to me? So God is partial because he's serving his devotee, but not me. But that's because he's reciprocal. So if we purify ourselves, if we show the desire to surrender to God, then he will reciprocate with us. In that sense, he's not partial. He's not partial to Ugrasen, and he doesn't dislike or hate Satrajit. But it has to do with what Satrajit's desire is. He's reciprocal with our desires. As you approach me, so I shall reward you. That's what I meant. So we can go back and then the master can.
You were discussing mental speculation. And that raised a few questions in my speculative mind. One is, to some degree, I mean, and I'm just throwing this out there for response. To some degree, everything we do in traditional life is mental speculation, because you never have access to all the evidence. You never have facility to make unlimited analysis, even if we did have access to all the evidence. So to one degree, we're just doing the best we can with what we have to work with. And we all do that all the time, if you look at it that way. So that got me thinking, what's the problem with this mental speculation issue? And I'm going to throw this out there and see what you think. There's a lot of pressure here. It seems the problem is when we project that our capacity to try to figure something out on that level, which is all we have access to and don't know what it is the equivalent of an absolute dependent analysis of everything that is or ever could be. And therefore, it's as good as anything that something can get.
Okay, so let me see if I understand your question. You tell me if I don't understand it. And then maybe you can ask me again. So the question, I think, has my interpretation of the question is that we use our intelligence to discriminate between whether this is an acceptable philosophy or not, whether this is right or wrong. And then we try our best to actually use our intelligence to understand the contradictions, to resolve them at some level for us, so that we can move forward in devotional service. So that isn't that speculation, because we don't really know what the truth is. Is that right? Am I understanding the question?
Well, I was thinking it was a little broader than that, but that also applies.
Okay, so then what's the broader aspect of this?
Just the broader concept of, because we sometimes, I do or others, sometimes throw around this mental speculation soundbite a lot. And it is relevant, but then sometimes there's a reaction to it that you people just have something against thinking.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's what I thought. So there is a difference between the mind and the intelligence. Mental speculation is occurring in the mind. What you're talking about is intelligence. It's discrimination. So, Prabhupada said we have to be intelligent. We have to use our intelligence. The Krishna consciousness movement is not a brainwashing movement. But I tell you, and you do it. No questions asked. That's not the understanding. That's definitely not the understanding we have. The intelligence has to be utilized in a proper way. If it is not utilized in a proper way, the mind takes over, and that's mental speculation. So the functions of the mind are to speculate. Now the intelligence, if it is subordinated to the Acharya's teachings, that's the difference. You know, there might be somebody who has an intelligence, who's an atheist, who's using his intelligence to support the mind's fantasies. Okay, and then he becomes contaminated, his intelligence is contaminated. As opposed to a devotee who has made the conscious effort to subordinate his intelligence. But how will he reach that level, that stage of willing to subordinate his intelligence to the Acharya's words? For that, he has to use his intelligence to understand his position. So the difference between a mental speculator and a thinking devotee is that the thinking devotee has taken his intelligence to the hilt, the maximum, and he's understood that he is limited. The
mental speculator's intelligence tells him that I can do it on my own. The thinking devotee's intelligence tells him that there are limits to my capacity to understand. There is some honesty involved. It has to do with character also. It has to do with purity and so on and so forth. So this is not mental speculation. When we try to use our intelligence to serve Krishna, that is jnani yajnena tenaham ishtaha syama iti me matihi. Krishna explains in the 18th chapter, he who uses his intelligence to study these instructions of mine, deliberates on them. Krishna has also given the instruction, deliberate, vimrushyeta dasheshena. He wants us to use our intelligence. In the 3rd chapter he says, you know, use your intelligence to control the mind. So, the main basic thing that the atheistic mental speculators are missing is a question of identity. Who are we? If we are just the body, then that leads us down a path. If we are the soul, that leads us down another path. But the problem is, the fact that we are the soul, that information is not available anywhere, except in Vedic scriptures or in other religions of the world. Maybe not. I'm not an expert on other religions. But my point is that we have to come to the realization that I have to accept this knowledge. Theoretically, a priori, I have to say, yes, maybe, let me assume theoretically I'm the soul. But where am I going to get that knowledge? It's only present in the scriptures. So if the atheistic philosopher says I'm only the body, then there's nothing to discuss. And that's actually the root of the mental speculative process. You know, divorcing ourselves from reality. So my point is, long-winded answer, not very logical, not very nicely arranged, but my main point is that there are some things in this world, our identity, for example, that we can't just think and arrive at conclusions for. We have to accept this knowledge from Shabda, from somewhere. And if that knowledge source is logical, as our intelligence is discriminating, it is beautifully laid out, it's consistent, it explains our world experiences, then we make a conscious effort to subordinate the mind's speculative processes to a much higher level of wisdom. You can't recognize if something is a higher level of wisdom unless you use your intelligence. So there are many hands up. Janmashtami Prabhu, and then I'll go to Madhumati Mataji, and then I'll go to Trivikram Prabhu. Yes, please.
There's one famous letter, I can't think of the reference now, where Prabhupada differentiates between mental speculation and philosophical speculation. Mm-hmm. And he describes philosophical speculation as favorable to devotional service. Now, I think in other places maybe philosophical speculation isn't spoken of.
In this Jnana Karmadi Anavrata, he translated it as philosophical speculation. So,
So, from my understanding, philosophical speculation is we're stretching our intelligence to understand tattva. Mm-hmm. We're facing all of the discussions and all of the considerations on Guru Sada and Shastra. So therefore it's still Avaroha Panta, yet we're alive and trying to deepen our understanding. And as Prabhupada said, we should discuss from different angles of vision. This was a key point in the Bhagavatam class. We wanted this to go on. And this is the philosophical speculation that we had in mind, which is actually favorable to Bhakti. It doesn't cover Bhakti. Huh?
Talking about intelligence, that we should use our intelligence in trying to, I guess I shouldn't say understand Krishna, but in serving Krishna, we use our intelligence. My question is, sometimes we may not want to, we accept what the Shastras say, and we accept it, and we don't try to use the intelligence to dissect it. Let's say just read the Shastra, okay, here is what happened, and you accept it. Is that being lazy, or you know, like here Jiva Goswami has given so many, you know, sandharvas, and there's so much knowledge in our scriptures. And one can use one's intelligence trying to understand it, or one can have the approach of just accepting the little the books that we have and just accepting it. I would like to hear what you think.
So Krishna is saying the seventh chapter, Bahunam Janmanavante Jnanavan Mam Padyate Vasudeva Sarvam Samhatma Sudurvatam. The gopis are not studying scripture. It is not mandated on every, you can't make a rule that every devotee has to study Jiva Goswami's steps and verbals, the practice and verbals. You know, as our talents, whatever we have, our inclinations, whatever inspires us in devotional service, we do that. That's the pratikulasya vajanam, anukulasya sankalpam. We accept what's favorable for our devotional service and we reject what's unfavorable for our devotional service. In fact, I came across recently Prabhupada saying somewhere, you don't have to study, or maybe, I can't remember where I read, you don't have to study so many books. Maybe it's actually a devotional principle. Yeah, that's what I read, the nectar of devotion. Somebody could help me out. But Rupa Goswami explains, you don't have to study all these different, so many books. And actually, it may not be favorable for our devotional study because we get confused and ultimately become Mayavadis or Brahmavadis. So there is a limit to what we can achieve. But the thing is that as our inclination takes us, whatever our inclinations are, we act on those and take them, that will take them towards Krishna. But if we have doubts, if we have fundamental issues with Krishna conscious philosophy, then we are being lazy. If we don't take the effort, we don't take the initiative to either approach a devotee to resolve those doubts or to use our intelligence to figure out what the problem is that is coming in between us and Krishna. So that's the purpose of the Guru. He guides us. Guidance means he's giving us specific solutions to our problems, our doubts. So it just depends on what our specific situation and what our problems are. Laziness definitely is a problem if we carry doubts and we just kind of go along with the program because, you know, you say, well, what else do I have to do? Or, I've done this all my life, so I'll continue doing it or something. That's not conducive. But if you don't have any doubts, if you love Krishna, if you're in love with Krishna, you take pleasure in relish, coming to the temple, doing darshan, then you don't need to, grapple with all the complex scriptures and all the different commentaries and all this on script and all that. Can you come here?
Coming back to Stitadi's question and comment. To some extent, what I grasp to, like certain topics are not covered clearly within the scriptures, and so sometimes a speaker may try to explain, to his intelligence or whatever, and he feels well, he has the real answer. Let me give you an example. For example. When we touch upon the topics of the dinosaurs, like the scientists discover so many dinosaurs, and I was speaking about it one day, and I said that they're simply large animals. They're huge fossils and so, but our scriptures have not. But Srila Prabhupada said that there's no extinct animals on the planet. So my conclusion was, well, since there's no extinct animal, then those large fossils have to be some form of what we have. Like I was speaking about the passage and so forth.
Prabhupada said there's no extinction, but he didn't say there's no extinction on this planet. He said, why just are the scientists focusing on this neighborhood?
So now I kind of lost the thread. So what is the exact question again?
Sometimes there are questions that's hovering, that's not properly being supported by the scriptures, or covered by the scriptures.
Mm.
And, you know, especially with scientific findings and so forth, our scriptures have not really covered, especially, you know, like the moon issue and so forth. So then, you know, for us, you know, I mean, like I was giving you an example based on what Prabhupada said and what the scientists found.
So what's the question? Conclusion. What's the question?
Well, the question is that...
What do we do?
Sometimes you're in a dilemma where you...
So what,
you
know, my view on that is that just as we have to recognize that we don't have the intelligence to understand Krishna, in the same way we have to understand that we have limitations when it comes to fields that are not our field of expertise. We are not paleontologists. And if you start arguing with the paleontologists, you make you out to be a fool. So we have to pick the arguments both with people and in our minds what to argue. Because I don't have the expertise, for example, in evolutionary biology. Even though I'm a scientist and I work in cell biology, I can't make any conclusions or comments about the science of evolutionary biology. I don't know the details, you know. So I can't argue with these people. Now, getting into these detailed arguments should be left to devotee scientists who have the specific expertise to deal with questions like this. And we should approach them and get answers rather than, you know, giving answers out ourselves when we don't have the qualification or the expertise in these specific fields. That's my not so humble view. But my point is, we have to be humble to understand that I don't understand this scientific business, these details. Even the scientists don't understand it. It's out of their expertise. So trying to reconcile that and spirituality should be left to people who have the specific expertise in those fields. So not, for example, Sudhapada Prabhu is an example. He, you know, did fantastic, he wrote fantastic books on this topic, and he's a genius, and his explanations seem reasonable. At the moment when it needs an explanation, you take the humble route. You say, well, you know, I'm not an expert in that area. Here is a person, here's a devotee scientist, Vithukarma Prabhu or Sadaputa Prabhu. And if you have read those books and you have some understanding, you can mention that. But, you know, my understanding is that this is so and so, but I'm not an expert. There's nothing wrong with that. You know? I'm not an expert, so I can't comment on that. That's fine. We can't... See, the problem is if we try to do that, and if the person is listening to the answer, discovers all kinds of holes in our argument, then we actually do a disservice to that person. You know? It's better to be honest about our limitations.
Purport in the second chapter, the 10th canto, where Prabhupada quotes Jiva Goswami, and he says that unless one can accept achincha in the supreme, you can't accommodate the conception of God. So this is inevitable. I mean, there are going to be many achincha factors that people bring to Tattva and Rasa. Things that are beyond us. Some of them we may realize later on as we mature as devotees. At least that principle is there.
So the materialists say that's a cop-out in the sense that you don't have an explanation, so you say lila or inconceivable. That's right. So the humility, if it's not there, then there is no discussion. There is no... Those two roads bifurcate based on our attitude, basically. What our attitude is, just determines. Like Krishna says, yo-yo shraddha sa eva saha. Whatever faith you have, that's what you are. You might be in the sattva, rajya, tamaguna faith, and then, you know, the belief systems.
I believe that reference comes, you know, with Goswami in the discussion of aroha panta and avaroha panta.
Cool. Yes,
yes. Knowledge, you know, and that requires you, and also the recognition of my limits.
I think the humility comes from purification, to some extent, in the sense that if we associate with devotees, we take some prasad, we have some agyat sukriti, then we kind of hold on. That is, you know, to lose the offensive attitude towards devotional practices.
That also comes with the realization of the absolute supremacy of the Lord.
That's a long shot for most people these days.
Yes, for devotees, that's all. Right.
Yes. I mean, for most people these days, that's an antiquated conception based on mythology. So, thank you very much. Pitagor Premanand.